Okay, good evening, everybody. Today is Monday, February 24th, 2020, and we are here at United Orthodox Synagogues in Houston, Texas, for the last of our two-part series, Great Jewish Letters. This is the fourth letter of the second series, and tonight we're doing a letter which is very personal to me, as it is the ethical will, the tzava, is the Hebrew word, of Rav Benny Eisner, of Binyamin Eisner. So what I want to start with is just a little brief note about the idea of ethical wills in general. Then I'll share some biographical information about Rav Benny Eisner. And then we will together study his tzava, his ethical will. So an ethical will is essentially a document that expresses ethical values from one generation to another generation. Someone who is either expecting their death, or even if they're not expecting their death, in anticipation of eventually dying, they want to put down on paper what their ethical beliefs are, and so that, and what their expectations, sometimes it also includes expectations that they have of their family, or sometimes it's to students. So that's essentially what an ethical will is. It's not a will of, in terms of who gets the estate. It's not a legal will in that sense, right? It's something of a different level. People want to make sure that those closest to them understand the aspects of ethics and character that were most important to them, and so they have expectations that the next generation carry them on once the person has passed away. The origins of ethical wills in Judaism are very, very old. They go all the way back to Sefer Bereshit, to the book of Genesis, where Yaakov, who's dying, gathers his sons right around his bed, and he blesses them, and he requests that they don't bury him in Egypt, which is, that's an aspect of an ethical will, not to be buried in Egypt, but rather to be buried in Canaan at Marat HaMachpelah with his ancestors. Moshe, in Devarim, before he dies, instructs the Jewish people to be holy and to act in a certain way. So this notion of leaving behind an ethical will, even though the ones that we talked about were verbal ethical wills, it goes back a long time. The ethical will that we're going to read tonight wasn't verbal. It was put down on paper by Rav Benny. But nonetheless, the same idea that we're leaving behind expectations and hopes for the next generation. Ethical wills continue to be popular, and they continue to be popular into our day and age. There are actually collections of ethical wills that people have left behind and that have been published. There are a lot of very well-known and heart-wrenching ethical wills left behind from the Shoah, where a common theme is, I don't know if anyone is ever going to read this, but if someone does, those often take the image of "Don't forget me, don't forget us. We lived, we had lives," because again, people, they really had no idea if anyone who ever knew them was going to survive. There's a well-known ethical will that came out of Worms in around 1050. Eliezer ben Yitzchak of Worms: think not of evil, for evil thinking leads to evil doing. Purify thy body, the dwelling place of your soul. There's a very well-known ethical will from Yehuda ben Shaul ibn Tibon, who was a famous translator. He translated, his son translated some things of the Rambam. And it contains sort of admonitions to the son who did not seem to be meeting his father's expectations, although he became a very famous and well-known person later on in life. He talks about his book collection and how the son should cherish the book collection. So there are a lot of very well-known tzavaot, we'll call them, ethical wills that are out there. And again, it has a very, very long history of being done. And again, there are collections of ethical wills that you could purchase in book form. And there are even guidelines, books that are sold, of how to write an ethical will. Right? You want to make sure that you're hitting on all the important points, so it guides you on how to write the ethical will.
Do these people usually write it for when they know they're dying, or any time in their lifetime?
It's both. Yes.
Is this just a Jewish thing, or are there ethical wills in other religions?
No, I think it exists in the general. Now it's becoming more popular and more common in the general population. But I do think that it has a strong history. It definitely has a strong history in Judaism. Okay, so that's a little bit about ethical wills in general.
Could they be sort of like the wills that we write today for...
Well, those are legal wills about where our money goes and where... What we expect our family to do in terms of financial matters. These wills have no legal binding, and they are not of those matters. They're talking about the ethics that we want to leave behind to our children, the behaviors that we expect our children to exhibit. Okay, so now a little bit about Rav Benny Eisner. So he was born on March 13th, 1943. And he died on October 29th, 2011. I'll give you some history. His history is in various places on the internet. There's a Hebrew Wikipedia page for Rav Benny, which says the following. He was born in Yerushalayim. He studied in elementary school in Tel Aviv and in high school on Kibbutz Yavne. After high school, he went to the army. And after the army, he studied in Yeshivat Merkaz Harav, which played the central role probably in his life, because it was at Yeshivat Merkaz Harav where he met Rav Tzvi Yehuda HaKohen Cook. Many of us know Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, the original Rav Cook, who was chief rabbi of Palestine. His son was Rav Tzvi Yehuda HaKohen Cook, who became Rav Benny's Rebbe, Rav Benny's teacher and mentor. And essentially for all of Rav Benny's career, he spent a lot of time teaching the Torah of the father and the son. Many of us who studied with Rav Benny studied Rav Cook's teachings with Rav Benny in his room, in his house. He taught a lot of classes in his house. Just a brief note about his army service. Rav Benny served in three. He served in the army and he fought in three Israeli wars, including the Six-Day War, where he was part of a small group of soldiers to liberate Kever Rachel, to liberate Rachel's tombs, which he considered to be a great zechut, a great honor. In his life. I'll continue with some of the more basic information. So his wife's name, may she live and be well, is Sarah. Her maiden name is Ulman. That's a very interesting story in and of itself. She comes from a very different background, more like a Hasidic Haredi background. That's just a very interesting aspect of his life, and one of the great aspects of his life that he was able to bridge all these different worlds. After he got married, he continued to study in Kibbutz Yavne and in Yeshivat Or Etzion, and then he became a teacher and a mashkiach, the mashkiach ruchani, in Yeshivat Yerushalayim Letzi'irim, which was the elementary school which was connected to Yeshivat Merkaz Harav and that sort of stream of Zionism. And again, he taught the teachings of both Rav Cooks. He taught in Yeshivat Ateret Kohanim. He taught in a pre-army academy in Eli, the pre-army academy in Ateret Kohanim. He taught in Kerem B'Yavne. From the American scene, he's most known for teaching in BMT, Beit Midrash LaTorah, where Todd right. studied and where I studied. I think one of the Brodies studied, Jeremy Brody, I think, studied there. Pardon me?
Did you know him?
Sure, sure, very well. There's a picture in the in here of him speaking under our chuppah at my wedding.
Oh.
And a couple of other pictures of us together. So he was most famous for, on the American scene, for teaching in Yeshivat Beit Midrash Torah, where he inspired hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, over the years of students, and remained very close to many of them, even after they graduated and moved back to New York. He started teaching. I think he started teaching there in the 80s, in BMT, which no longer exists. His impact on a friend of mine, right after he passed away, put something on the internet. Right after he died, I wrote something to our congregation about Rav Benny. But my friend, who wrote some introductory remarks before what I wrote something very interesting, but I think it's true. It said, men like Rav Benny played a fundamental role in shaping the last generation of American Orthodoxy through the influence that they had over their students. I think that's true. I think it's also true in terms of just so many people were his students. They came back to America and built Jewish families and built Jewish communities and participated in the communities as leaders and members of the community. So his overall influence was very, very widespread. And I'd say that one of his greatest characteristics was his openness to all students. He certainly had his opinions and held them very, very strongly, but he managed to make everyone feel that they were his favorite students and managed to make everyone feel that he was very close to them. I can't tell you how many weddings, you know, he was brought into to the United States for by his students, because everyone really, really loved him very, very much.
Can I just say something? It wasn't just the students. We came to Israel to visit Barry, and he took us into a house like we've been friends for 100 years. He was just a very open person.
Right. Okay, so, and he had a very, very profound effect on my life. I probably, I guess from your perspective, it's his fault I became a rabbi. he really had a very profound effect on my life, and I miss him very much. And so when he died, his family sent a copy of his ethical will, which you have in front of you in Hebrew and in English. And I decided to translate it with the help of some friends. And so we're going to go through it. And we'll see from the perspective of ethical wills, it's very interesting what he wanted his family to know. This is clearly an ethical will meant for his family, as we will see. But there are a lot of things that we could learn from it as well. Okay, so he starts off by saying, this morning, everything has changed. When you hid your face, I was terrified. I called to you, O Lord. To my Lord, I made appeal that my whole being might sing hymns to you endlessly. O Lord, my God, I will praise you forever. That's a quote, a pasuk from Tehillim. It is easy to have faith when all is good and pleasant. When your body is in your power and you rule over it, suddenly there is a refusal of orders. It's hard to walk, hard to sit, hard to find a comfortable position. So obviously Rav Benny is writing this when he is sick. He's not feeling well, right? He feels his own body is failing him, right? Suddenly there's a refusal of orders, meaning He can't do the things he wants to do. It's hard to walk, hard to sit. So he is not feeling well at all.
So how old was he when he was sick?
So he was not sick for long. He had pancreatic cancer, so he was not sick for long. He was born in 1943. He died in 2011, and he wrote this. We have a Hebrew date. There's a Hebrew date on the. There's a Hebrew date on the ethical will. So I'm going to look up the. I'm going to look up the Hebrew date right now, so we could get a. We could find out when he wrote it. He wrote it on the 2nd of Cheshvan in the year 5772. So that corresponds to October 30th. No, well, that cannot be, because I have... Hold on 1 second. October 30th, 2011. Okay, hold on 1 second. So maybe I had his dates wrong. Something's wrong with this, because the date of his death is October 29th, 2011. This is dated October 30th. So my assumption is that this is the release date. This is not the date he wrote it on. This is the date that it was released on, because he died on Shabbos. And this is right before Shabbos, on Friday. And so this was released on Motzei Shabbat, Parshat Noach, right after he died. Okay? Tzavat Avinu, it says, Tzavat Avinu Morenu Ateret Mishpachtenu HaRab Binyamin B'Reb Yitzchak Yehuda Eisner Zatzal. The ethical will of our father and teacher, the crown of our family, Rab Binyamin, the son of Yitzchak Yehuda Eisner, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. That's not the will. Those are just, the dates and the family introduction. Now he writes an introduction, Hakdama. And so the first paragraph I wrote was, in fact, what Rabbeni wrote, and obviously he's writing it from a perspective, he's already feeling very, very sick. Ethical will for the year 5823, God willing, my 120th birthday. So you see that he noted that he always had a lot of, Rabbeni was a man of great faith. He never, ever gave up hope. And he never ever gave up the belief that God totally loved him. Like, even when he was very, very sick, I had the opportunity to visit him in the hospital when he was going through treatment, and I sat with him at his bed, and he never lost faith even for a second. And you see here that he writes similarly, that this ethical will is really for the year 5823, which would be his 120th birthday, Ad Me'a Ve'esrim. But he wrote it now, anyway, right? So you see that he doesn't even want to give the impression, that he feels that that he's dying. Okay. Master of the universe, my only desire is to cultivate the love of God in the world. Into your hand, my soul I place, for your miracles and for your wonders that are at all times. Which is true. His only desire was to cultivate the love of God. He dedicated his entire life to teaching. That was the only career he ever had. And that was the only thing he really loved to do. In fact, he writes in here, and we could just skip to it. If we skip to number 15... This is a really very beautiful point in the will. Number 15, he writes, mother, which is referring to Sarah Eisner, his wife, and he often called her Ima on many occasions. My dear, loving and devoted wife, may she live and be well. I request all of you show her great honor Mother will choose where she will be and with whom, and all with peace, calm, and happiness. And then this is the point I wanted to get at. I would not have been able to learn, teach, and bring our brethren to service of God, may he be blessed, without the endless assistance of Mother. It started with her freeing me from concern for livelihood and monetary matters, and culminated with all of her concern for my students and her never-ending welcoming of guests. May the good Lord pay her due, and may she merit to live with you in pleasantness many years. And so I mention this now because it relates to what he said, my only desire is to cultivate the love of God. Knowing Rav Benny, was very clear that he was really only focused on teaching, and everything else that was going on in the household and all the other technical details of running a household were very much Sarah's, his wife's, responsibilities. That was their beautiful partnership that they had together. And as you see, he notes that he, because of her, he had the opportunity to just totally focus on learning and teaching. And now here we come to the actual points. Number one, there are books in my house that are not mine. Please return every book to Ateret Kohanim, Talmud Torah Marasha, or to any other place where they belong. Right. So we're going to see here that this is a very practical document. There are not a lot of lofty things in this document. That's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is those are the lofty things, right? Those basic things that we're responsible for in life, like making sure that if we borrowed something, we return it. Those are the lofty things, right? Those are the most important things. And so we're going to see a lot of that in here. And so Rav Benny had a gigantic library of books. In fact, it was, at least I experienced this, he would give books, some of his books, to his students as gifts when he came to visit, and he would inscribe them also beautifully. He another way of sharing his Torah, but he had some books that he borrowed from the yeshiva. We all do it. I do it too. I have a book, I borrow a book from our library that I have at home. And he wanted to make sure that they got returned and didn't sort of get swallowed up into his library. Mm-hmm. And so he makes sure that they, in fact, get to where they need to go. Again, not a very lofty thing. He's not talking about, making world peace and bringing the Mashiach, but he's talking about being an honest person. And similarly, in number two, ask if there are those to who I owe money to, or if I borrowed something from someone, and return it to the owner. He doesn't say specifically in this case that he does, but nonetheless, he wants to make sure. Number three is a very interesting one. Mm-hmm. None of my children may attend my burial in accordance with the custom of Jerusalem. Okay. So there is a custom in Jerusalem. It's a debate as to why this custom exists and for how long this custom has existed. But I actually did some research on it today, and Shlomo Brody, Miles Brody, actually wrote an article about this custom, about may children attend their father's funeral, and he notes that the common custom, the modern custom that we have, is probably from the 17th century, meaning it's not a very old custom that children in Jerusalem do not attend their parents' funerals. And there's Kabbalistic reasoning behind it. The most well-known reason is because there are certain, the father is concerned that there are certain sins of the father that will be remembered by the presence, remembered by the spirits or by the evil spirits, whatever that means. I'm not sure what that means, by the presence of the sons, by the presence of the children. And so at a time when the father is being buried and you don't want any of his sins to be remembered, You don't want the children specifically to be there so those, in order to make sure that those sins are not remembered. I know it all sounds very odd and out of the ordinary and mystical and Kabbalistic, and that's, in fact, what it is. And still, to this day, there are certain cemeteries, certain Chevra Kedisha organizations where they tell the children, they don't allow the children to be at the grave. Some of them have compromised and don't want the children walking after the grave. There's different ways that different cemeteries deal with it. A lot of people do not like the custom. It is not practiced outside of Israel and is only practiced in Yerushalayim. But anyway, we don't have to get into more detail than that. You could look up the article yourself and read it. But anyway, Rav Benny wanted to maintain this custom.
Is it just the father and mother too?
I think it's just the father and the sons. But Rav Benny wrote the way that he wanted it. There's none of his children.
Yeah, but what about is it just for the father of the children, or will it also apply to the mother?
I think generally it applies to only the father and the sons. But Rav Benny said none of his children may attend, including his daughters. He has daughters. So that's the way he wanted it to be. Okay. Then he says to his sons, number four, my request of my sons not to miss putting on tefillin for the first year after my death. Well, it's interesting, right? Why only the year? That's very interesting. I don't know what expectations he had of his sons, but he wanted to at least for the first year, like Glenn is saying, when you're saying Kaddish and when the body is making the transition from this world to the next, and there's certain elements of being judged, he wanted to make sure that perhaps in his merit, they would be wearing tefillin every day, and that would reflect well back on him and would help him in his transition from this world to the next world.
Were his kids religious?
Yes. But maybe he's being just realistic that sometimes things happen and they're not in your control. But he wanted them to make special efforts for the first year of his death. Number five. It is more important for a mourner to serve as the Shaliach Tzibur than to say Kaddish. Nevertheless, in no circumstances should you argue about who should be leading services. This is one of my favorite lines in it, because as a rabbi, I see this often, right, that people argue over who should lead services. And I always wonder to myself, is this the way that the deceased would want to be honored, by you forcing yourself and fighting with someone else to be the leader of the services? I know it's very important for people to lead services, but Rav Benny is noting that it's also important to maintain peace, to maintain shalom, and he tells his children that they should not argue about it, and perhaps if there's someone else there who really wants to, even though they may have the right to, they should not argue about it. So again, we're seeing not these great lofty principles, but very, very important ideas in terms of honesty, in terms of shalom bayit, right? Not arguing about who's going to lead davening, shalom bayit in terms of making sure that they treat his wife respectfully. It's interesting because Rav Benny was a person who in his lifetime talked a lot about lofty ideas, right? He talked a lot about Kiddushah, about holiness, about making ourselves holy, about the holiness of the land of Israel and about the holiness of the state of Israel and about Mashiach and about the importance of building the Jewish people and building the Jewish state. He talked a lot about lofty ideas, but here, when he's leaving behind to his family what's really most important, he's very, very practical. Okay, number six, write on my gravestone only Reb Binyamin. Now, I do not believe that that is what the family did. They wrote other things on the matzeva. Now, in the Hebrew, it says, L'chtov al hatziyun rak Rav Binyamin dot, dot, dot. which could mean that there were other things that he said, but the family did not want the public to know. There was a picture.
It would be written on the matzavah.
Right, there is a, but that's true. There is a picture of it, which I found recently. I'm trying to, I was able to find it recently at one point. I'm trying to see if I could find it now. I did have it at one point. No, I don't. I don't have it here. Maybe I'll try to find it. Try to find it afterwards. But in any case, that's what he wanted. Okay, let's continue. Number seven. I request to be buried close to. So
blank.
It says. Well, I left it out because the Hebrew has it. Bikashti liyot samuch lebetzalel zal im ein makom samuch lemori v'rabi harav tzvi Yehuda zatzal v'aviv. I do not know who that is, but that's who Rabbeinu wanted to be close to if there was no room next to his Rebbe. Let me just see if I could find out who Bezalel Zal is.
Even to ask to be buried next to Rav Kook, it's too much. I mean, who is he that deserves it? I mean,
well, he is near him. He is in the general area of him, but
where is he buried, in Har Herzl?
No, he's buried on Har Hazetim, I think. Yeah. Okay, I don't know who Bezalel Zal is. I haven't looked at the Hebrew in a while, so I didn't remember to look up.
He died before his parents.
No.
He died first. I mean, he left his parents.
No, him? No.
His parents were dead.
Yes.
How come he didn't ask to be buried next to his father?
I don't know. He wants to be buried next to his Rebbe.
How about his wife?
She's still alive.
She's still alive.
She's still alive.
But now she won't be buried next to him.
I don't know. Pardon me?
What happens when she passes? She won't be buried next to him?
I don't know. Maybe she will. Maybe there's next to. Maybe there's room. I don't know.
They marry the women next to the men?
I don't know. He's harazetim? I don't know. I don't know. Okay, let's keep going.
As long as it's
next. The eulogies should be given in Yeshiva Kitana Morasha. Do not be lengthy so as not to inconvenience the attendees. And God forbid, do not exaggerate with praises of qualities I do not possess, as one is punished in Olam Haba for that. So he wanted honest, straightforward eulogies. Regarding books that I own that are Morasha, Morasha may keep whatever benefits them. Number 10. Give 2,000. Shkalim to the Talmud Torah in place of money that I did not return or that I received not in accordance with the law in order to attain forgiveness for the sin of theft. So again, very down, very practical matters. He wants to make sure that his slate is clean when he dies. I profoundly request, please, that you remember the ethical will of Rav Shlomo Alba to not get angry. Work on that characteristic always. So you see, he actually references another ethical will, and he, in that ethical will, Rav Shlomo Alba says not to get angry, lo lichos, and he says to work on that character trait all the time.
To be angry on what?
In general, just not to get angry. He does not want his family members to get angry. It is written that when children sin, their father suffers because of it in heaven. Therefore, my loved ones, those who are very dear to my heart, I know that you are certainly united and that you truly love each other. Please love your fellow as yourself. This is the foundation of the entire Torah, and it starts with brothers and family. This was a regular mantra of Rav Benny, of V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. And as I said before, he had this amazing capacity to love everybody, even those who he had profound disagreements with. I remember, actually, this memory just occurred to me, that when I was studying in BMT, we were, I don't know, 18, 19 years old, and we were going to spend a weekend, I don't exactly remember where, in Israel somewhere, and we were going, on Friday, we were going to go into an Israeli elementary school, and we were going to provide some informal programming for the kids. And a lot of us were very nervous. We're going to have to do this in Hebrew. Our Hebrew was not very good. It was, I guess, good enough to get the points across. It was not very good. We didn't know what we were going to do. We were very nervous. So a bunch of us went to see Rabbi Benny, and he basically said, just make sure that you know that you love them. As soon as they know that you love them, they're going to be open to whatever you want to say. If I remember correctly, it was a non-dati school. It was a non-religious school, and we were supposed to give some religious programming. And that's one of the things we were nervous about. He said, doesn't matter. As long as they really feel and really believe that you love them and you care about them, they'll listen to you and you'll have a good experience and everything's going to be fine. And, of course, he was right. And that was right out of the Rabbi Benny playbook.
Did they make fun of you?
No, they didn't make fun of us, actually. They didn't. Always remember, envy, lust, and the seeking of honor drives a person from the world. Live with abundant love. Each one should help the other in any way possible. Then the divine presence will dwell within our entire family, that God, may he be blessed, has merited me and Sarah, a joyous mother of children, with all these years of purity and happiness. So he's really telling his family, right? He wants to make sure that his family maintains shalom bayit, and that they look after each other, and they love each other, and they don't argue with each other. Again, this is the very personal nature of this tzava. Number 13, and this is what I named the class, Wear a Seatbelt. This is really amazing. Mm-hmm. More deaths are caused by car accidents than in wars against our enemies. Therefore, always be patient when driving. Always yield, even if the other driver is 100% wrong. Even if you are in a major traffic jam, patience, yield. Do not drive at all if you are tired. Rest on the side of the road. This is a matter of life and death. Do not spare any expense with regards to automobile safety, including tires, brakes, etc. Always fasten your seatbelt. So talk about non-lofty ideas, right? Talk about sort of prosaic, very down-to-earth ideas. Right, it's right, right, exactly. Right, right, exactly, right. It sounds like, doesn't sound like something that you would put in an ethical will, but he wanted to look after his family.
Well, the death roads in That's Israel. No, but the accidents in Israel.
Speaking of driving, I will tell you this story that was told to me by another one of my teachers. This story was told over many times after Benny died, but I heard this story when I was a student in BMT, so long before Rav Benny died. The story was told to me by Rav David Miller, who was the Rosh Kolel of the Grus Kolel, which is the YU Kolel in Israel, which shared space with BMT. If BMT was on the campus of the Yeshiva University Israel campus. And Rav David Miller tells a story that once he and his family were on their way to the airport to catch a flight from Ben Gurion, and it was raining, it was pouring, and their car broke down, and they were on the side of the road with no way to get to the airport, in danger of missing their flight. And sure enough, like Eliyahu Hanavi, out of nowhere, Rav Benny pulls up in his van. And he pulls up, which was full of his children, and he tells all of his children to get out of the car in the pouring rain. He puts all of the Millers in his car, drives them to the airport, and then comes back afterwards, presumably, to get his family. So I don't know where Rabbeinu was headed that night, But he was just there, and that's the story. It's a legendary story of Rav Benny. I hope I got the details of that story right. Number 14, you shall live by them. There is one purpose in life, sanctification of God's name. Here we get to something a little bit lofty. I remember what I said, that Rav Benny was always talking about Kiddusha, about sanctity. So he's saying here that there is one goal in life, which is to sanctify God's name. That's in number 17, in the Hebrew, and number 14 in the English. V'chai bahem kol chayenu matara achat kiddush Hashem. Our whole life has one goal, sanctification of God's name. To bring ourselves to the greatest level of perfection possible, because by doing so we bring the Jewish people to its perfection. And through that we bring the world to perfection, and then God will rejoice in his works, and his blessed will, the end of which, the end for which he created all the worlds will be done, that God's goodness emerge in all its force. And so that's a mantra, like I said, that Rav Benny always talked about sanctity. That's the highest rung on the ladder of the Jewish character traits that we can try to attain, that we can attain, our own sanctity, our own kiddusha, and to sanctify God's name. And as you see here, everything falls into place when you sanctify God's name. Number 15. Oh, we read that already? That's the one about making sure that they give his wife the ultimate kavod, and that let her make whatever decisions about her future life that she wants to make, because she was the, and he notes that she's the one that allowed him to
learn to do
his life's work, to learn and to teach. And finally, prayer. If I will not merit a miracle of long life, so you see here, he's again recognizing that it's going to take a miracle for him to live much longer. I ask that one of the speakers at my funeral recall the words of Rav Kook, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, in Alot Raya, Volume 1, Page 2, which is Rav Kook's commentary on the Siddur. It is impossible for prayer not to make its mark, whether it does its work guided by its own specific goal or takes long and winding paths. These are among the wonders of He of Perfect Knowledge. No prayer returns to Him empty-handed. This is a really interesting, I'll explain, a very interesting statement that Rav Benny is making. So I'll just explain it first, and then I'll see if I could explain what's behind it. So what Rav Benny is saying is that what Rav Kook is saying is that prayer works in two ways. One is it could work in the specific way that we intended it to work. I ask for someone to be granted healing, and then they're granted healing. I pray that someone have a refuah shleima, and that they're granted healing. I pray that the rain comes, and the rain comes. I pray that I have a successful year financially, and I have a successful year financially. Right. So there, one way that prayer works, as Rav Kook said, it works guided by its own specific goal. Whatever the goal we had of the prayer that we uttered, it works. However, he says, sometimes it doesn't work. Certainly doesn't work right away. And Rav Kook says, or it takes a long and windy path, meaning we've asked for financial success, we've asked for healing, we've asked for safety or security, and sometimes it doesn't hit the exact target that we directed it at. But I think this is what Rav Kook is saying. Once we put out there a prayer for healing, there is a healing spirit that has been released, mm-hmm. and it will attach itself to some target. Right? We may never know which one, but it will attach itself to some target.
Also, our right? prayer is not for nothing.
Somebody Correct. That's what he's saying. No prayer returns to him empty-handed.
Somebody, somewhere.
It lands somewhere. It may not land exactly. It's like an arrow. We are shooting for the bullseye,
yeah.
And we may miss the bullseye. We may miss the entire target, but the arrow lands somewhere.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Right? So that's what Rav Kook says, which is actually a very beautiful way, beautiful explanation of prayer. And I will tell you that I heard this also from the mother of one of the three kidnapped boys. If you remember, those three kidnapped young boys in the Gush. And one of the mothers, when she came to there was a mass tefillah for them in at the Kotel, and Naftali Frankel's mother, he was one of the boys, she actually said this exact thing, and that was in 2014. So what Rav Kook is saying, I know everyone's praying. Rav Benny, I think, is saying, people are davening for me. And if I don't merit a long life, this is how I understood it. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if this is what Rav Benny meant. But what I understood this to mean is people are davening for me.
Even if I'm dying.
And if I'm going to die, don't lose faith in prayer. Right? Some good is going to come out of your prayer. Even though it may not have helped me and it may have not landed on the target, which is me, right? Even though that may not happen.
It landed
somewhere. Someone is right. The healing, I call it the healing spirit, whatever, the healing prayer, the healing power of the prayer is going to land somewhere. And that is the last thing that he leaves everyone with. Meaning, because as I mentioned earlier, I think Rav Benny knew that his time was coming, even though he had great faith and fully believed that there could be a miracle. But he didn't want his family, and I guess anyone else who read this, who davened and really hard for his well-being, to lose faith from his death. And so he puts this out there as the last thing. I also think it's very appropriate and not an accident. Again, this is just my read of it, that the last thing he shares with his family is a teaching from Rav Kook. Right, because Rav Kook, he often said that the son, Rav Kook, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, saved his life. Right, sort of put him on the direction that he was on. Doesn't mean he saved his life physically, but he said, he would say, he saved my life, mamash. He literally saved my life. And the father of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook is Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, who is the author of the statement, and because Rav Kook, Rav Benny's life was so wrapped up in the teachings of Rav Kook, it's very fitting, right? It's very fitting that the last thing he says in his, the last thing he writes in his tzava is something from Rav Kook. That's sort of the last piece I wanted to mention, that's again my own editorializing of this I'll also tell you just something else interesting that that Sarah Eisner told me when we were talking about Rav Benny once after he died. Rav Benny was a big Talmud Chacham. He was a big Torah scholar. His expertise, if you had to ask what his expertise was, his expertise was really in machshava, right, in Jewish thought. He studied a lot of Gemara and a lot of Halacha, but that wasn't what excited him to learn, really, and that wasn't what excited him to teach. What really excited him to teach was thought, the thought of Rav Kook, the thought of Rav Yehuda Halevi in the Kuzari, the thought of Rav Kook's son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, the thought of the Maharal. He gave classes of the Maharal of Prague. Those were the things that were his expertise, and those were the things that he really introduced a lot of his students to. That's just a little side point about the just a type of teacher that he was. Everyone has their favorite things that they like to teach and they like to learn, and it was very clear what Rav Benny's were. You could also tell that by the books that occupied space on his bookshelf. Right? You could tell what a person likes to learn by the books that they own. And he really, really was very attached and very connected to Machshevet Yisrael, Jewish thought, and that's really where he made his mark in terms of the impact that he had on his students.
Did he go to college?
No. He did not go to college.
He had a tremendous impact on the students.
Okay, so thank you everybody for coming to all the classes, especially to this one, and have a wonderful, wonderful day. Evening.